and I take it personally, and I know I shouldn't, it's a business. A lot of the jingles were just people throwing saucepans at the wall, but no musicality. It's a bit like you've got a problem and you appoint a surgeon. You don't tell them which scalpel to use.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. David Arnold.
I grew up in a, I wouldn't say it was underprivileged background, but it certainly wasn't a posh background. And I went to primary school, but then I was fortunate when I was 11, I took the 11 plus and managed to pass that and went to the local grammar school. Now, up until that point, I wasn't interested in music at all. In actual fact, I got a report from primary school, and under the heading music, it actually says, shows little interest, which is bizarre, bearing in mind my whole life has been spent in music. My mother is the opposite of people who have perfect pitch. She's Geordie, and she'd call a spade a shovel, very honest with everybody, and she would speak her mind. But she really wouldn't know the difference between the top end and the bottom end of a piano. You could say which one is higher and which one is lower, and she was literally tone deaf. And after I'd done this for a living for a little while, somebody asked her, what type of music do you like? And she said, well, I like background music. I was in the Scouts at that point, playing the big drum and a snare drum, and I went to grammar school in the first week, and they said, does anybody want to join the orchestra? And I thought, well, that's brilliant. Can I play the drums? I'll play in the orchestra. And they were playing a very quiet Bizet piece. And I thought the bass drum had to play all the way through to keep everybody in time, which isn't how it happens in Rossini or Beethoven. And so I remember being slightly embarrassed, the music teacher telling me off and saying, would you just stop playing that drum all the way through? What are you doing? And I said, well, isn't that what's supposed to happen? I said, no, you've got quite a bit to learn. So at that point, I started to have lessons on the drums and got better, more proficient at it. And if you're a percussionist, which I was, you have to play the xylophone and the vibraphone and timpani as well as the drums, which means you have to learn notes as well as rhythms. And so that went on, and it was the one thing in school that I absolutely adored and couldn't wait to get to the next lesson. And I obviously showed some ability at it, and then went on and took music, GCSE, and so on. At that point, I decided that I wanted to do this professionally, or at least go on to the next stage. And somebody told me about the Royal College of Music, and I thought, well, that's, I couldn't possibly aspire to that. And then somebody said, but then you've got to have a second instrument, which I didn't have. So at the age of 16, I had a crash course in learning to play the piano. And I did grade 5, I think, in 6 months. And by the time the end of the year was up, I'd got grade 8 in piano, literally within 1 year, which is very fast, and much faster than you would imagine. Normally you would take a grade a year. So I managed to compress 8 years into 1 year, and then applied for the Royal College of Music halfway through my A-levels, because I was desperate to want to do this for a job. So I went to the audition, and my dad had a Ford Prefect. So he took me up to South Kensington from Harold Wood in Essex, where I was brought up. And I wheeled my xylophone into the Royal College of Music and played the piano for them. And I must have done quite well, because they said, would you be able to come back this afternoon? And I thought, oh, this is obviously a borderline thing. And I said, well, yeah, I can come back this afternoon. Is there a reason, special reason for that? And they said, yes, the scholarships are starting this afternoon, and we'd like to consider you for one. And I'd got no idea that these existed, bearing in mind that lots of kids who go there are primed to get a scholarship. The whole previous 5 years have been heading towards that one event, and I'd got no idea it even existed. So I went out to my dad, to the Ford Prefect, and said, Dad, I've done the audition, but they want me to come back. And he said, well, look, I'm on a parking meter. Are you absolutely sure? You can't you just, you know? And I said, no, that Sir Keith Faulkner has asked to see me. And he said, oh, all right, well, I'll go and find another parking meter. They were already put out about this. And I went back and played the xylophone for Sir Keith. And I did get a music scholarship, which meant for the next 3 years, I was at the Royal College of Music with like-minded people. And it was like going to paradise. because I didn't know there were so many people interested in music, all on the same wavelength, all in one place right opposite the Albert Hall. And so that's where all this started. Meanwhile, they encourage, and I think they still do, in your third year, they encourage you to take professional engagements so long as you can still attend. And I played with the touring orchestra of the Royal Ballet in my last year, and so Nureyev and Fontaine were there, and I'd be in the pit playing for them. So that was a fantastic privilege. But then, of course, the 3 years of education comes to an end. And at that point, I've got to get a job somewhere. And I was playing as an extra person with initially the London Philharmonic. So I'd be down the line somewhere. So I wouldn't be number one xylophone or two xylophone, but sometimes there would be six of us and I'd just scrape in and be number six for a while. Then, and this sometimes only ever happens every 20 or 30 years, somebody left. So there was a position as the third percussionist in the London Philharmonic. So I applied for that. I remember getting the job, we were playing at the Edinburgh Festival, and there's a milk bar just to the north of the Usher Hall, and the principal percussion player said, "Do you fancy a cup of coffee?" And he took me up there and offered me the job. And this was another one of those moments that I couldn't believe that, you know, life had led me to there, and I was actually going to get the job of my dreams, and it had been offered that day. And so again, it's purely a matter of luck, because if you play the cor anglais, for example, with the Royal Philharmonic or with the London Philharmonic or the London Symphony, people have that job and stay for 30 years. So you've got to wait for the position to be open.
These transmissions are in preparation for the new independent local radio service for South Essex, which will be provided by the IBA's contractor, Essex Radio.
In 1981, a friend of mine, I was at school with him, had been at school with him, he said, "Oh, I read in the paper, in the Romford Recorder, there's a new commercial radio station in Essex, and it's a brand new one, it's launching in September, and I wonder if you and I could offer anything." And we thought, well, I don't really think there's anything we could possibly offer, but let's cold sell them. And my friend Dave Weaver, who's now a vicar as it happens, phoned them up and said, "Look, there's a kind of a writer here and a musician, is there anything that you could possibly offer us, do you think, or is there anything we could do for you?" And the chap running it was called, a friend of mine now, no longer with us, sadly, Eddie Blackwell.
Very proud to be the chairman of the company that I helped to launch.
He was a bit of a jack the lad, Eddie. He said, "All right then." He said, "I'll tell you what, I've got a new program controller. This bloke, Australian, very good. John Wellington." He said, "And where do you live?" "Gidea Park." And he said, "Well, look, we're in London doing something and we're going back. We'll come back via Gidea Park and we'll stop at your house and we'll have a brief discussion." And John Wellington told me afterwards, he sat in Eddie's car and said, "Look, give these characters a quarter of an hour, because that's going to be enough. You know, we've had a busy day and all the rest of it." But John Wellington came in and I offered him, I got my grand piano in the front room. I said, "Well, John, would you like a glass of champagne?" And from that moment, we didn't look back. John said, "Do you know anything about jingles, about station branding, oral imaging, all that stuff?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely everything is to know, knowing nothing at all." And John said, "Well, I tell you, maybe we could work together." And of course, at that point, I was then the principal percussion player of the Royal Philharmonic. So I'd been promoted to the next orchestra by 1981, which is when they launched. And so John was there and he said, "Well, what we need is a tune that goes do 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 do, and it's supposed to be Radio Essex." And I got it back to front. And I'd done something that said Radio Essex, and really it was Essex Radio. And he said, "Well, I tell you what, why don't we turn that bit upside down?" And John started to get involved. And so John's sitting kind of in my front room with the piano, and we knocked up what became probably one of the best themes that we ever did. It was 1981. We got the Royal Philharmonic to play, there was kudos there, but John was the one who taught me how to do it. I'd really got no idea about in and out of breaks and the news does this and why at the end of jingles that go into breaks, so you don't have B big fades on the end, because there'll be tonal clash between one and the next, and about how you could even change tempo if you're going from an abrasive fast jingle into a softer track. Music can even do that. And John said, yes, this will be called a fast to slow. And so I knocked up a few fast to slows and the other way round. And so I built up a kind of an identikit of what station jingles were. And so really, the two of them, again, sadly, John passed away this year, but without that sliding door moment, then I would never have been involved in radio at all. And the hundreds, literally, of radio stations throughout the world that I've provided this product for would never have happened. And so I just think it's a fantastic thing to see those doors opening and then taking the opportunity to go through them. So I'm lucky, again, not premeditated, but I'm just lucky that I happen to be in front of that opening door.
Hot and sunny, temperatures falling to 16 degrees centigrade, that's 61 Fahrenheit. Winds are easterly and moderate. Round the coast, the sea's fair, the sky is clear and visibility is less than a mile. The outlook, a fine warm evening, some mist tonight with a chance of thundery showers tomorrow. Stories coming up. A 2-year-old
my
Essex boy
my daughter
savaged
was
by a pet dog.
Three detectives at that point, and every time an Essex radio jingle came on, she would start to laugh. And it hasn't left her now. But it's quite an odd thing, because she realised that I was quite pleased listening to them. And she kind of, somehow, that got through to her. And so she would, you know, laugh and actually recognise the fact that it was Daddy's stuff that was on there. I still listen. Not to Essex Radio, because, of course, it's all changed in the last 40 years. But the stations that I do, you know, and I still listen to them and I still monitor them. And even now, I phone up Sam Jackson at Classic FM if there's been a particularly good segue. And I'll say to him, Sam, that's how you do it. That's what you, and that's what I aspire to. And he always gets back to me. He says, yeah, I like that one too. And so, no, even though, you know, I've done it for 40 years, I'm still fascinated by the whole subject. People seem to be interested in this new approach of oral branding. Because at that point, there were people like Sue Manning was around. Center Radio. And Alpha Sound, I think, had just about started. Radio Trend 301. But there weren't that many people doing it. And I don't think there was anybody writing for big orchestras. It was one of those things. And though this kind of took the attention of several programme controllers. And the second person, it would be a year later, who said, actually, we're interested in this style that you're developing. Would you like to come down and have a chat? And I said, OK, where is this? And he said, I'm in Wiltshire. I'm in Wootton Bassett. My name's Ralph Bernard. And, of course, since then, Ralph and I, we still see each other every year or so. We still keep in touch. And he's one of those people, I just really love his company. And he keeps on seeing me, so he must quite like me, I suppose, as well. But Ralph was one that kind of set me up. And I remember going to the Wootton Bassett Primary School round the corner because they had a piano. Of course, nowadays it never happens this way because of computers and so on. But Ralph said, I'll tell you what, it's summer holidays. Come round, I'll phone up the headmaster or the caretaker. And can you come knock out the tune for Wiltshire Radio? It's Wiltshire Radio, WR, that tune. And so I knocked it out on the piano and Ralph made some fatuous remarks about it, and we went for a curry. And then eventually, you know, we built up Wiltshire Radio.
It's 5 o'clock. This is Sue Newland.
A few moments ago, Britain's 37th independent local radio station opened up for the first time.
And that
was
the second one. It's Wiltshire Radio. And then it went on from there. Then it snowballed. And I think Southern Sound was the next one. Keith Belcher, Rory McLeod. Again, they like this big orchestral thing.
The Southern Sound theme, written by David Arnold and played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
And then the BBC got involved in it, interested. 1,000 jingle packages later, we're still here. And with BBC Local Radio, again, it's different now. There's kind of one package fits all for all 39 of them. But in the early 90s, I actually produced jingles for 26 of the 39 stations. It was that many.
Radio Cambridgeshire.
And because there were 39 different stations to pitch for, there was that much more work. But of course, nowadays, there's one person who makes a decision.
Good morning.
So that means there are 38 potential clients that you don't have. And of course, it's exactly the same with independent radio. It used to be the people we were talking about, Essex Radio, Wiltshire Radio, Southern Sound, and whole lists of them. Now I have kind of six clients, and you either get 30 stations or you don't get any of them. And so surprisingly, I mean, the market itself has really shrunk. And so there aren't lots of jingle companies around, and I think you can, they're probably on one hand, you can name the people in this country who've ever, ever written a jingle package for radio. Yeah, I forget the chap's name. He's a lovely bloke. And we said, what we like to do, rather than taking a stab in the dark, I mean, we know who you are, we know what your output is. Do you have any inspiration tracks? Something that's about the right tempo? Something is about the same depth of orchestration? Something you'd like? And he said, yeah, absolutely. Driving Miss Daisy. And we said, are you sure? He said, yeah. And I said, so we're going to turn that into a travel jingle. And, well, driving, I suppose I can see the connection. And then into a news jingle. And so the whole of that package was based on Driving Miss Daisy. But with this, I mean, it really depends on the melody. Of all the different sections of music, melody, rhythm, harmony, the one thing that's unique and identifying and the most important thing is melody. Okay, so Driving Miss Daisy has a tune, and that particular tune, because we can take it and put it into different clothes. And so you can turn it into a news jingle, and you can turn it, but you have to start out. Well, first of all, you have to start out getting the contract, and somebody comes up with a harebrained idea of Driving Miss Daisy, and you have to kind of make it work. And sometimes you can make it work, and you can see through it. And other times you think, do you know what, I really can't figure out. And then we go back to the previous conversation. If you're insisting on that, it would be better for somebody else to do it. And we're quite honest about it, because we all have reputations, and you don't really want to give them something that won't work, and you know won't work.
FM Stereo 102.7 Arrowwood Radio.
We had done the music for Tomorrow's World, and they were thinking about relaunching it, and they wanted a new tune. And so we were involved in this, so we wrote them a tune. And then they came along, we call it a triple-headed snake. They came along to the studio, and we played them the tune. And one of them looked at the other one and said, note number 7, if that was to go up rather than down, how would that sound? And we said, OK. And so we went away, did it in 5 minutes, came back. And then somebody else said, I think that's an improvement, but what about if one started down and then, and this went on, and they all had a view? There must have been about 8 of them. They all had a view about our tune. And of course, the whole thrust of this is the melody. And a melody is written by a musician. A melody is remembered, like Schubert said, somehow it's always there. And it's very rarely successful when it's done by committee. Anyway, this went on and on and on, what seemed a week of them doing it. Then they got somebody who's interested in the money. And they got the financial people involved. And they thought they'd join in with the note game. And somebody came, after about half an hour, they're scratching their heads with their clipboards. And somebody said, but what happens if note number 7 is the same as note number 8 and you repeat it? And this kind of got applause from the eight people. They thought, oh, this was a great idea. So can we have the same note time? None of us have thought of that. The final thing that we said prior to ushering them out the studio was, the financial person said, well, all this up and I've sat here for 3 days, all this up and downing and notes the same, does it have any financial implications? And I said, no, largely, whichever series of notes that you choose would be roughly the same price. And so don't worry. And so they went away and got somebody else to do it. But they're kind of the extreme things. I mean, there is a point where you have to say, do you know what? I don't think this is working. And I don't think it's ever going to work. And so I think it's a good idea if, you know, you were to get somebody else to do it. And we are honest at the end of the day. If we're pushed to that extent, even if it's a contract that we would really like, and we know that we're not pleasing them and then it isn't going to work, we would say that. And we did one, a filmy type thing, and we'd done a really lovely score for it. And the director came along and said, oh, I think it's too busy. What happens if you turn the violins off? And we said, OK, so we turned the violins off. And he said, you know, it's still too busy. And we turned off whatever the next one was. He said, no, that high one, can you get rid of those? And in the end, we had a kind of a drone, and there was nothing there at all. And we said, there's one more button we can press. And if you press that button, that's how you get out of the studio. And so and so he disappeared. And the thing is, there's no point in appointing somebody. It's a bit like you've got a problem and you appoint a surgeon. You don't tell them which scalpel to use. You know, I mean, they're there because they're an expert at what they do. And we feel we're not putting ourselves on that medical level. But it's one of those things, you know, we have done this before and we know what works and we know what lasts and we know what's going to be good for you, probably more than you do. And so at the end of the day, if you're going to change it all around, it would be better if you were to write it yourself. I used to play for other people's sessions, and I actually played for Jeff Wayne on the original LBC jingles, on the do-do-do-ding. Ding, da, 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 ding, ding. So that was me playing the timps on it. But that's before I actually started to write anything. So I was involved with LBC even then. And they decided they would get rid of that tune. And this often happens, that radio station looks at its demographics. It has to be more contemporary, it has to be more this and that. And some, you know, somebody comes up with the idea that that brilliant jingle package, and Jeff Wayne's jingle package is still one of the best ones even now. And actually, it was brought back a bit later on, you know. So it was reinstated, but then it disappeared. They charged Brian Hayes, who was then, well, he was a presenter, but I think he was head of something, or that this was his position. And he was charged with getting 8 different pitches from different companies. And I think Jeff Wayne declined to pitch because he said, you know, you're aware of our work and we can adapt it and we can extend it. But, I mean, Brian was charged with the fact that he wasn't going to pitch. And so it was down to the 7 of us. And we came up with various ideas. And they chose that first tune.
Welcome to the musical sound of LBC. On the 21st of September 1987, London's news and information station, LBC, introduced a number of new programmes, changed the style of some of its existing ones, and introduced a brand new music package, a package which was perhaps the greatest indicator to the audience of those changes.
The inspiration for the package came from David Arnold and composer Mike Moran.
1152 kilohertz AM, LBC Radio.
The 6 o'clock news, this is Douglas Cameron. After signing the medium-range missile...
And again, that lasted for 4-5 years, I would think. And then I think we did one after that. And then, of course, inevitably, we got the sack. And then Ralph Bernard, who actually, funnily enough, the one we mentioned earlier, decided that LBC should go back to Jeff Wayne, which is what he did, and then Jeff got the sack. And I think I was the next one back after that. I understand they have a choice, and I don't mind. I think that's the right thing to do. And often going out to pitch is the right thing to do. But I take it personally, because really, it's largely me. If it was a company and there were 6 and 7 of you and then you could commiserate with each other. But what I loathe, and this happened to me recently, I won't say which radio station it is, but we pitched for something and didn't get it. And then I listened to the new jingles and I could write a portfolio about what's wrong with them, you know. And you think, God, they've really chosen them in preference
to what I do. And I take it personally. And I know I shouldn't. It's a business. And you move on to the next one. But I can't help but thinking, what are they hearing that I'm not? Because that, to me, sounds awful. And literally, I could write a list of how they could improve it. But that's not required at this point, because that door has closed. That's the end of that one. I always think that in life, you know, the only things, if you're a jingle monger, are taxes, death, and you're going to get the sack at some point. And I've certainly, I think I've had the sack from virtually every radio station in the country. At the end of it, quite a few of them have come back latterly, but generally people move on and people think of jingles and all branding as something that's kind of interchangeable and let's just buy the new one. And of course they're quite wrong. Really, if you have a wonderful, adaptable melody that can grow with the output, and I quote Classic FM from 1992, and so that's been there all those years. And if you were to play the jingles back to back, it's over 3 months worth of solid broadcasting. Well, make no mistake, that isn't an accident. That's because it's highly researched and it becomes part of the brand. And it's exactly the same with Jazz FM and Lyric FM in Ireland and Classic in Norway. All of these jingle packages have lasted for decades. And everything has moved on with the times, but the melody can move on with the times as well. And so that's the starting point. I work with Andre Previn quite a lot, and he had everything. Fantastic writer, fantastic conductor, fantastic raconteur, and he was one of those people, and I've seen him do it. He would stand up in front of a room full of people, but I know that radio people can do this, but we humble musicians are very rarely charged with it. But Andre Previn could do it, and he would stand up and entertain, you know, for 10 minutes. And actually, I went on tour with him to Japan, London Symphony Orchestra, and afterwards he would go to the club. And most conductors wouldn't do that, or even indulge the orchestra, or even be part of it. But Andre would come along, and he came along, and was just drinking in the corner. And there was a Japanese pianist in the corner, and we happened to notice he was playing from sheet music. And so we opened the sheet music, and it said, "Play like Andre Previn." And so anyway, we went over, and we said, "Andre, why don't you just go and play for him?" And so he went over and said, "Would you like me to play for you?" And the Japanese bloke looked up at Andre Previn, then looked at Andre Previn's photo on the front of his music and said, "Jesus Christ, it's Andre Previn." And so Andre played for him for 10 minutes. And the bloke was in his element, absolutely adored it. He couldn't believe this music that he'd been stumbling through for the last decade. You know, the actual bloke who wrote it was there. And so there are wonderful moments like that, that again, you couldn't ever set it up. Well, it happened in the 90s. Everybody wanted to go to Dallas. And the very first package I did in Dallas with Jam, with Jonathan Wolfert, because he was doing Radio 1 and Radio 2. But then there were lots of other stations, potential stations coming on air that we're talking about, commercial stations. And Jonathan thought it might be a good idea to get into that market as well. So I went to Dallas and did a BBC Radio York package, which is the very first English package to be sung by the Dallas Singers. FM, BBC Radio York. And so that went well. And then the BBC found out not only were they great singers, but also you got a free trip to Dallas on the rolls of it. And so quite a few of the BBC local radio station programme organisers, they were called in those days, were over to Dallas. And virtually every other package then was done in Dallas, because, of course, they have a syndication that we don't have in this country. So if you write a jingle package for Kiss FM in Los Angeles, you can rub off Kiss FM and call it something else, FM and so on, Fox FM. But it means that all the backing tracks are already done, and of course they're a quarter of the price of having your own custom-made jingles. So everybody went to Dallas, including BBC Radio Cleveland and all the others, Radio Berkshire, and all of them were over there. 1548, Radio Cleveland. There will be Jam, Century 21, or TM Century as it became, and then TM Jones and Tom Merriman. So there were three, and they're jingle singers, all of whom would sing for all three companies. It was a full-time job for them. And the seven singers would do, you know, Monday at Jonathan Wolfert's and two sessions on Tuesday elsewhere. And so it was a really full-time job. But as a result of that, it was a bit like the best string quartets. They were breathing together. The articulation was absolutely perfect every time. Every T and every consonant was absolutely together. And I couldn't believe how good they were when I first went. And so I looked at them at the studio and I thought, there's some sort of trickery going on. It can't possibly be that good. So I went into the live studio and sat in there. And, you know, it was them. They were that good. And there was just a microphone in between. So there was no fancy compression or anything, or limiters or anything like that. In that room, they just sounded stunningly good. And the reason they can do that is because they sang together all the time, just like an orchestra. I mean, an orchestra who plays together all the time is much better than a scratch orchestra where you get the trumpet player from one place and trombone for other. And so the Dallas Singers are stunningly good. They have one unique voice that we could never match, this chap called Jim Clancy. And he could sing the low F at three lines below the bass clef. He lived on a ranch with racehorses, and he reckoned he paid for all that by just the word M or F. And so all he would do every day, they'd all sing, he'd go F, M, and do the very low note down there. And so his whole life was brought to you by the letters F and M. That's all Jim could sing. But he had a unique voice, and I don't know, I haven't been to Dallas for a while, whether he must be of retiring age. And I don't know if there's another one. But he was certainly part of that sound. Radio Mercury. Then it got, about the mid-90s, it got to overkill. And everybody was sounding exactly the same. Everybody was sounding a bit like Kiss FM. It was kind of at the end of a cliff face. And then nobody wanted sung jingles at all. Moreover, they didn't want orchestras, because that had been done. So we got into sound design. And I've never been a big fan of that, because it doesn't actually say anything. But a lot of the jingles were just people throwing saucepans at the wall, and there were lots of noises and sound effects, but no musicality. And that lasted for about 5 years, until people started to realise, but there's nothing unique, there's nothing identifying about this at all. It was cheap, for sure, because you're not paying for musicians or singers, but all it is noises. So then it gradually started to creep back, and we're now doing big orchestral jingles and singing jingles, and we're back to where we were. It's a bit like that Schubert always said, that good melodies are just remembered. And it isn't a question of composing one. Sometimes you would go along and the melody takes as long as it takes to sing, just to write. And I guess you would say that was the inspiration of a composer. And the good melodies last. And good melodies don't irritate. Good melodies can be dressed in different clothes. My complaint nowadays with composers, a lot of people, radio jingle type people, they compose by numbers. And because computers are so good, you can literally just press buttons and come up with some sort of contrived melody, but somehow it's a manufactured melody, and it's not a melody from the heart that a musician would give. And people often say, but you're going to run out of tunes, aren't you? And the answer to that is no. Leonard Bernstein said the infinite variety of music, and there are as many melodies as from now to Kingdom Come. And so we'll never run out of good tunes. People might not remember them, but there's any number of good tunes, and it's only a question of plucking them from the air and presenting them.
This is a test transmission in preparation for the launch of Classic FM, the United Kingdom's first independent national radio station, which will begin broadcasting 24 hours a day from 6 a.m. on Monday the 7th of September.
When Classic first launched, the very first people to get the contract actually were called Showtime Radio, and they couldn't capitalise. And so really, Ralph and Eddie, you know, were the next ones in line. Obviously, I'd worked with Ralph Bernard for a long time, and Eddie Blackwell was there. and they went around to all the banks and somehow managed to get the money together. And Ralph said, OK, we're going to go and we're going to do some jingles for that. Would you come in and explain to the board what these are and how you propose to do it? So I went to the boardroom, I think, was it at Oxford Circus or Camden Town or somewhere? And there were a load of money people up there, none of whom not only knew about jingles, but didn't know about anything other than money. They certainly didn't know about broadcasting. And Ralph said, so explain what you're going to do. I said, well, we have this melody, we have this theme, and when you go into an advert, you know, it can do this, and a news jingle can do that. And one of the money men said, well, I don't understand this, because is this an advert then? And of course, I realised that he'd have no idea how this ever this was going to work. Anyway, so I played them a few demos, and they all sat there kind of nonplussed, kind of fiddling with their teacups, not really knowing what all this was about, and could they get on to the next subject? And then there was a silence for about 10 seconds. And Eddie Blackwell, God bless him, said, well, I think all that's bleeding marvellous. Yeah, let's do it. And then they all started to nod their heads as if they really understood what was going on. And so then we were given the go-ahead to go into the studio. And again, we had a huge orchestra, Rolf and Lemonic, and 19 years later, whatever it is, and it's still there. No, 27 years later, it's still there. I'd prepared about four or five different demos, and again, you know, it's which one of these tunes do you like? And so they didn't really have an opinion. But just before the presentation, it suddenly struck me the front end of one jingle would fit really brilliantly on the back end of another jingle. So I said, well, here are the demos, but really what you should be doing is this. We start, dun 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 ding da 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 dun dun, and then we end, da 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 da. And they looked at me as if I should be committed. They thought, who on earth is this bloke who's singing things to us? And so, again, they were nonplussed, but Ralph and Eddie said, oh, yeah, I think that's a really good idea. And so they nodded again, and so I went away and nailed the two together. But it's quite an odd thing. It suddenly occurs to you. Maybe it was the meeting itself that prompted this. And I thought, yeah, no, I think I know how this could work better. And that's how it happened. Well, it's the most wonderful thing you can do. We went to the big studio where all the films were done in Wembley. It's called CTS. And my favourite moment of all, and this is with concerts as well, where, you know, I have my own dressing room in the recording studio. I'd be in the control room, and you see the orchestra coming in with their violins and trumpets and setting up and opening the microphones and all the rest of it. And you hear the first snippet of something that up to that point only exists in your mind. And you can hear the trumpet playing going, da 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 da. And you think, oh, yes, that's that. And gradually it comes together. And then over the recording, there'll be one or two tricky bits for one or two of the instrumentalists. And you can hear the flute going, and all the bits that that you know are going to be tricky, you can hear them all practicing 5 minutes before. Then I walk on. And theoretically, there's silence, but not often. So I walk on and kind of tap the bat on, and they say, oh, yeah, what are we doing today? And we start. And normally, the first run-through, you know, I just get a real thrill from hearing the orchestra. And it very rarely happens, but sometimes it's much better than I could have ever imagined. And sometimes it's not really quite as good as I imagined. But that moment of actually hearing it for the first time is the most wonderful thing that a musician can have. And particularly with concerts, if you can, with your bat on, you can control people's focus of attention down to a very, very small space. And so literally the flick of your little finger would make a difference to the way they respond to you. And sometimes if you get absolute silence and the orchestra just all breathe together, I mean, it's the most wonderful feeling. And I do find my eyes welling up with tears. I really genuinely do. I mean, I try not to let that affect the performance, because you have a responsibility and you don't really want somebody crying on the stage, because that wouldn't add to the performance at all. But no, I certainly feel that, and I get a kind of a tingling in my cheeks when it goes really well. If it's not going that well, then you tend to get more nervous about the whole thing and you tend to blame yourself. And again, that's an ability to overcome that and to get to the next stage and then to do your best, because you've got a responsibility for 70 of them. And so you can't be seen to be letting them down. You know, the general who asks the permission for everybody, you've got to lead them, and they come with you. You know, and they can sense these things as well. They can also sense when it's breathtakingly beautiful. You can tell, just literally from the ethos of the radio station, you can kind of tell what will work with them and what doesn't. And I think all you can do is rely on your instincts. You know, it's an impossible question. I mean, that's a bit like, you know, so why do you fall in love? It's just one of those things that happens, and you have to bring them with you. And you can say, look, I know this is going to work. I mean, you have to trust me. You know, after a week, you know, whether this is struggling or not. Instinctively, you know that this is wrong. But of course, they've paid their budget. And so it's very difficult to back out. But also, it's a bit like choosing the school for your children. Even if it's wrong, you still kind of back your endorsement. And you still say, oh, no, it's a very, very good choice. And I'm afraid it's a bit like with jingle packages. Even if you've come unstuck, and because they've spent the budget, they tend to stick with them. But they use fewer and fewer and fewer of them. And they go into the library and get other things to replace them. That's what happens. If you were to go to the average person in the street and charge them with writing a news jingle, they go, well, it's obvious, isn't it? It's... And so we have to somehow be more creative than that. And obviously you can't have it done with banjos and bagpipes. And so it has to have a degree of seriousness. But you have to take a middle line, because sometimes it's the skateboarding duck, and other times, you know, somebody would have died and it's a serious story. And so you have to kind of choose a piece of music that fits all. And I think that's the ability in it. And so you don't want Star Wars all the time, but nor do you want the love theme from Superman. But it has to kind of be somewhere in between that fits all the stories. Sometimes it's a question of not being obvious. And that's why Benjamin Britten was such a good composer, because he would say, I mean, the plots might well be, you know, the crackling of fire, and you think, oh, well, the violins would use the wood of their bow, that's the obvious thing. But he would turn that into a flute quartet. And so sometimes you have to take it not at face value, but you have to do something that would fit, that you could see just fitting into that slot, but without being too obvious. And I think radio stations now have to be unique, because it's all highly, highly competitive. And so it's those things that make the difference, because it's not just the same as everybody else. There's something identifying, there's something unique about it.
We started when I was chatting to the designer of the actual news thing, and we were talking about ideas and things of sounds, and he was basically after a sound that everybody would recognise. And one of the things that we mentioned was the pips.
There's a chap called David Lowe who composes the music for 10 o'clock news, and he doesn't read music. So I'm not, you know, criticising Dave, because he's a very good composer, got a great deal of respect for him, but he can't write the crotchets and quavers. And so what he would do in that particular occasion, he would give me the MIDI, and so what he would play on the keyboard, and he gives that to me, and of course it comes out as kind of one up from gobbledygook, because it's not real music, it's just kind of samples and kind of numbers, and then I translate that into music for the orchestra to play. And so I make it work for him. And the other use that I've got, and an increasing amount of this, because quite a few composers now can't read music, but they can't conduct the orchestra either. And so they wheeled me out to do that. And so it was the BBC Concert Orchestra at Abbey Road. And so I would go along and conduct for him. And if there are any wrong notes, and I can help.
Now, you may have noticed that we've been blowing our own trumpet here on BBC World News this week about our new look in our brand new studios right here in the heart of London. Well, as part of the redesign, we've even recorded the music you hear at the start of each bulletin all over again. We've used a full orchestra at the legendary Abbey Road Studios in North London, where the Beatles did some of their greatest work, of course.
That seems to be one of the things that I do now, because an increasing number of composers don't read music, which is an odd thing, really, You know, it's almost like you've got loads of pilots, trained pilots, all of whom can take off, but they're not very good at landing. And in a way, with composers, it's a bit like that. You know, they're very, very good at actually composing the music, but they're not very good at the mechanics of getting it recorded by an orchestra. So that's perfect for me, because that means I can help. It's a revenue stream for me. I've kind of been lucky that I kind of spread myself in at least four different directions. And if I'd been relying solely on radio jingles, I probably wouldn't be doing those now, because there wasn't enough work to be doing that. But that would be one of the things that I'd do. Then I do television signature tunes and so on. I did a lot of that at one time. But again, with that, the budgets have gone down and it's highly competitive because of computers. Or I do library. If those two aren't working, then I do library music. I do quite a lot of that. And I can always fill up with library tunes. I mean, people are always wanting me to do things, so I'm never redundant. Or, of course, I'm associate conductor of the Royal Philharmonic, and so I still conduct with them. And so of those four things that I do, I'd probably get the sack from three of them, but the one remaining one will see me through, and I think that's how I managed to scrape through.
This is London.
I went along to Bush House, and again, there was a committee there. Murray Holgate was the chap who was coordinating it. This was in 2000. And again, it was round the table, and we were talking about, was Lily Bolero going to be any part of this, and was there a tune that was going to be compatible? And we came up with an idea that Willie and Lily, and so we had our tune that kind of butted onto the end of Lily Bolero, and that lasted, I think, for 5 years or so. And again, gradually that filtered out, and now they've gone somewhere else. But it could well be the World Service. I wouldn't be a bit surprised, from the ashes, it might well be that they like melody again. I think that tune, in a way, it's folly just to cull it altogether. I still think that in its quest for modernity and being contemporary, that getting rid of something that's as iconic as that, they probably could have integrated it somehow. And it's what we're talking about, that you can take the brand along and you don't have to kill it and start again. A lot of radio stations do that. If you have to take your tune and replace it every 2 years, you don't have a brand. It's as simple as that. And I think with the World Service, I haven't listened to them for a while, but I don't remember any particularly outstanding melodies that I'm taken away with. Well, I just wondered, I went along to the Royal College to see a big band concert there only a couple of months ago, and all the kids, you know, between 18 and 21, many of whom were brilliantly talented, and I just wonder what they're going to do for a living. Because it's not just the Royal College, it's the Royal Academy and Trinity, and there's several of them in London, as well as in Manchester and Edinburgh and so on, Glasgow. And I don't think there are that many jobs. And really the role of the session musician barely exists now. And all the best players, because it was highly paid, would be session musicians. And now those people have filtered down to doing West End shows. And of course, the people who are doing West End shows are being peripatetic teachers and so on. So I do fear for kids who are coming out expecting, after practicing for 5 hours a day, that they're going to have a job at the end of it, because it's not guaranteed. And to make a living doing it, you've got to have lots of qualities. I mean, you've got to be brave and you've got to put your foot in the door, as well as being a brilliant musician. Of all the different symphonic pieces that have gone on throughout the last 40 years, the thing that always makes me laugh is the music for Channel 4's Big Breakfast on the television. It's a trite little tune, but it went on for 10 years, and Chris Evans and Gabby Roslin had the most fantastic viewing figures and kind of outgunned ITV and the BBC, a minnow company. And that tune, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, always makes me laugh. But of course, every week we had to write a new competition tune, and it went on for a decade. So all those tunes, like Get Your Knobbly Nuts Out and Morty Vicar, I've got a great fondness for them. So I think probably, you know, with a degree of levity, that's probably one of the best things that I ever did. But my dad, actually, he's still with us. My dad's 99 years old. He's coming up to 100 years old. He's in a care home, but does have a fantastic musical ability, but it was never realised, because coming up from Bethnal Green, where he was brought up, nobody played the piano there or the violin, so he didn't have the opportunity. And it makes me wonder how many Yo-Yo Ma's and Andre Previns there might be out there, you know, who've never had the opportunity. They've got the ability, but they don't have the background. My dad is very, very musical, and even now he can sing along, and he hasn't lost his sense of pitch. But his aspiration for me was to play the drums for Kenny Ball. And if I'd done that, he would have been deliriously happy. And the fact, further along in my career, conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra at the Albert Hall, it was a bit of a disappointment. Because I wasn't playing the drums for Kenny Ball. But my dad got used to the idea that I kind of ploughed a different furrow to the one that he'd selected for me. And I think now he's really quite pleased, and I think he has the bragging rights in his care home. You know, oh yeah, my son conducts the Royal Philharmonic, and I don't know if anybody can understand him, but I think when he has got bragging rights there. Well, you know, after 40 years of doing this and going through degrees of desperation, you know, mortgages and young families and all the rest of it, I've got past that stage. And really, all I need to do now is to do my best, still be fascinated by the whole subject, but not doing it specifically to other people's direction. I hope I never lose that enthusiasm, and I see the future now. If people think I'm any good at what I do at all and they want me to do it, I'd love to do it. But if they don't want me to do it, that's equally lovely. I think we all have defining things about us. And when I go to musicians' parties, I tend to go less frequently now. We're all introduced by something we've done. And I tend to be introduced, oh, this is the bloke who did Classic FM. I met another bloke and I said, what do you do? And he said, I wrote Karma Chameleon. And so that's what he does. Classic FM is what I do.
David Arnold. For more in this series, follow the podcast, Radio Moments Conversations.